"There is nothing on this earth more to be prized than true friendship," wrote St. Thomas Aquinas. In fact, he went on, "Friendship is the source of the greatest pleasures, and without friends, even the most agreeable pursuits become tedious." This is the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Jesus made it clear that while the first and greatest commandment is to love God, the second is to love neighbor. And neighbor, for Jesus, even extends to our enemies. In the second part of the Summa Theologiae, St. Thomas Aquinas explored the question of love, love for neighbors, love for enemies, and love for friends. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, theologian Dr. Jeremy Holmes led us through Thomas's thinking. Here, in part, is his presentation.
So my hope today is that St. Thomas Aquinas will be our actual lecturer, and that I'll act as a kind of medium, hopefully allowing him to speak to the group. What I would like to do is set up the topic, and then I'm aiming to have a kind of alternating, I'll talk a little bit, but highly interruptible. We're not going to have time to go through each segment of the reading. The way that St. Thomas writes, he takes what would have been a disputation that would have unfolded over a leisurely day, right? Say, maybe on the Feast of Corpus Christi, just have a big academic feast. And then he just bakes it until it's powder, like in a little sachet for you, and he puts it into the Summa. So you're supposed to add the water and dilute it back to the original consistency. We're talking about love of God. And Dr. Schubert had mentioned earlier Rousseau's sort of sentimentalization of human love, and that's one great example of just the ways in which love is so cliche, right? Love is so cliche that love being a cliche is a cliche. And Christian love is no better, right? Charity is this coin that's so well-worn you can't see the face on it anymore. Like, is that Caesar's face or God's? I can't really see now. Christians are hard-pressed to articulate, what is it that makes Christian love different from any other admirable love? You know, Gandhi's love, or that love Aristotle refers to, whereby people all over the world help travelers. It's a natural humanitarian impulse. Christian love seems to be understood as God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other. Okay. How do we articulate the difference? Well, we start resorting to true but kind of peripheral factors like, Christian love has something to do with social justice, and it differs from worldly social justice because we take our inspiration from Jesus Christ, who showed us an example of love for the marginalized. Or Christian love differs from other loves in that it extends even to enemies. Or Christian love differs from other loves in that it focuses on individual persons rather than on impersonal programs. All right, all this is true, but it doesn't touch the essential distinction. And it's all of it capable of being imitated by a secular world that wants the exterior benefits of Christianity without the interior commitments. So St. Thomas, in our reading for today, captures what I think is the essential distinctive point about what is it that makes Christian love different from all other love in a single, short, and deceptively simple phrase. Charity is friendship for God. Now, I say deceptively simple. We're going to spend our whole time today unpacking that phrase. The danger with that phrase is the general danger with reading Aquinas. I think that is when you read Aquinas or Scholastics in general, it's very easy to slip into an abstract mode. You know, John Henry Newman makes a distinction between notional grasp of things and real grasp of things. It's very easy to slide into a just merely notional mode and not think in a real way about what is being said. So it's easy to say friendship with God and have it just sort of, the words just wash over the mind like pizza going down the throat. You know, just, friendship with God. And I think that the week we've spent so far together is very helpful in this regard because we've attended to concrete instances of friendship and we've talked about our concrete, real friendships. so that you can bring in your vivid ideas, your vivid experience of friendship, and then you put it up against the idea of friendship with God, and something immediately becomes clear that we typically don't mention in our homilies, namely that Christian love is impossible. I mean, it would seem, right, that Dr. Virginia took us through a bunch of examples of friendships between unequals, and one of the themes we've talked about this week is how inequality can be a problem, right? And if it stretches too far, it can break the friendship. Let me read you something from Aristotle's Ethics. This is from Book 8, but not a section that we read together, where he reflects on this difficulty of inequality. This becomes clear if a large gap develops in respect of virtue, vice, wealth, or something else. Then they are no longer friends, nor do they even expect to be. Imagine living next door to Bill Gates, right? You don't even think you're going to be his friend. It never crosses your mind that you're going to be his friend. This is most obvious in the case of the gods, since they are the most superior to us in all good things. But it is clear also in the case of kings, since people who are much inferior do not expect to be friends with them, nor do worthless people expect to be friends with the best or the wisest. In cases like this, there is no precise point at which people cannot remain friends. For friendship can survive many losses. But when one side is removed at a great distance, as God is, then it is no longer possible. Now, to feel the difficulty that Aristotle's pointing to, you need to feel the distance of God, right? One of the courses that I have taught frequently at Wyoming Catholic is Theology 201. That's the sophomore theology course in which we study the nature of God. And I love teaching that course. It's almost like an intellectual baptism because it introduces people to this difficulty, which is the foundation for appreciating everything that Christianity has to say. The experience of the students in that course is something like the experience you have when you're driving towards a mountain that's, far, far away. You could say, wow, that looks big. And you keep driving, and you drive, and you drive, and it looks no bigger. And you start saying to yourself, oh my goodness, that must be really big. And then as you get into the foothills, you're starting to say, I totally underestimated how big that thing is. And then when you get to the foot of the mountain, you just look up with this feeling of reverence. Oh my God, this thing is, I can't see the top of it. That's the experience of students beginning to think seriously about God. That we can say in a casual way, oh, God's being is infinite. And as long as it's merely notional, you don't see what Aristotle's driving at here when he says friendship with God is just not possible, right? We can get a hint of it. We talked about the difficulty when we were discussing Odysseus and Penelope, right? The difficulty of friendship between mortals and immortals. And we had this brief exchange about, well, it seems like maybe Odysseus has kind of a thing with Athena, but not really, right? Mortals and immortals, they seem to be too unequal. But the gods of the Iliad and the Odyssey, compared to the Christian God, is they're like Marvel comic book heroes. I mean, they're like really big people that live forever. The God that Aristotle's talking about, even just from the point of view of a philosopher, is already so transcendent that he can't begin to think about being friends with that. Right. So that's one difficulty. Another difficulty is that we've emphasized again and again in our conversations this point that Aristotle makes about friendship, and which is just common sense, namely that friendship involves a shared life, right? Even a good friend, you live apart for a long time, and it fades, right? So having a friendship and maintaining a friendship involves sharing a day-to-day life with your friend. Well, how are you going to get that done with the invisible, immaterial, incomprehensible God that we believe is the God of Christianity? And the Old Testament as a whole seems to have as one of its main goals to drive that home. Just how far from us, how above every conceivable deity the real God is, right? That's the whole theme of idolatry in the Old Testament. Idolatry is giving into the temptation to see God as not so beyond. And by the end of the Old Testament, the message has been pounded in painfully and with blood and sweat and agony that the real God is so far from your grasp that you can't make an image of him. And when Moses asks, "Can you give me your name so I can tell people who we're talking about?" He says, "I am who I am." Right? He kind of denies him a name. Of course, that becomes his name. I mean, that's a whole theme, right? But God sort of tells Moses, "Don't try to box me into a name. I am who I am." Right? You can't get it. So you might be thinking, okay, the miracle of Christianity is that we somehow manage to love God himself above all things. Right? And they say, okay, charity is surely love of God above all things. Let's drop the admittedly important talk about social justice. Let's not be distracted by relevant but not central issues of being fair or nice. Let's admit that Christian love is loving God above all things. But surprisingly, St. Thomas would say, no, you're not tracking me yet. That's not it. I'm going to steal part of one of Thomas's arguments and repurpose it for the introduction here. Question 26, Article 3 of the Secunda of the Summa Theologiae, in the I answer that section. St. Thomas says that God bestows natural goods on us, just as the Creator, and a common share in the natural goods bestowed on us by God is the foundation of a natural love, in virtue of which not only man, so long as his nature remains impaired, he's got a little disqualifier for the, to take into account the fall of man, right? And not only man loves God above all things and more than himself, but also every single creature in its own way. That is either by an intellectual or rational. Intellectual maybe if you're an angel, rational if you're a man, or an animal if you're a dog, or at least by a natural of as stones do, for instance, and other things bereft of knowledge. Because each part naturally loves the common good of the whole more than its own particular good. And he gives this example of civic virtue, whereby the citizen will even die for the polis. So he's making this amazing claim that every creature, just as a creature, has an immediate inclination to love God above all things, more than itself. Now, man is rational. Man is not driven simply by instinct. So we have to choose to follow or not follow that built-in dynamic, right? And this is where the question of the fall comes in. Do we actually choose to do it? But in St. Thomas's scheme, hey, the stones are out there loving God more than themselves. Don't give yourself too much credit, right? So what does this argument mean? I'm going to explore that for just a moment. He's talking about part and whole, and St. Thomas distinguishes between two kinds of wholes. The example he gives from the city is from what he would call a whole that is from the parts, right? Where the parts come together to make up the whole. That's the one that's easy to get, and that's why he uses that as the example. But when he talks about God as a kind of whole with respect to the creatures who would be kinds of parts, that's what he refers to as a whole that is before the parts. And an example that he gives is, if you think of a house, the various materials the house is made of are its parts, and the house is a kind of whole that is from the parts. But if you think of the house that was in the architect's mind, that's a whole that came before all the parts. And he says, God is in that position with respect to everything. Every creature, just by necessity, is some kind of reflection of God's perfection, right? When God goes to create, that's what he's got to give. This is his own perfection, right? So every creature could be, what is a dog? If we had the ultimate God's eye picture of things, we would be able to say, well, a dog is this kind of reflection of God's perfection, whereas a tree is that kind of reflection of God's perfection, right? So his argument could be something like this, right? You look in the mirror. Now, imagine that your reflection in the mirror is sentient and rational, right? What is it going to see as it stares back at you? And what is it going to say? Well, it's not just going to see that you are way, way, way better than your reflection. It's also going to see that its own goodness as a reflection is contained originally and more completely in you. And it's going to say, you are the fairest of them all. And every creature is in that position with respect to God, right? The very tomato plants, just trying to be tomato plants. What is it? What is the thing they're trying to be? They're trying to be that kind of reflection of God. And St. Thomas would say they have no idea what they're doing, but in their own way, by a kind of natural groping, they're loving God even more than themselves. So not even love of God above all things is what makes Christian charity different from every other admirable love. Not on St. Thomas's account. So what is it then? You know, I start to feel like, oh my goodness, the task of defining Christian love is going to be impossible if that didn't do it. St. Thomas takes his starting point, and here we're back at the first part of this reading selection, the article on whether charity is friendship. He takes his starting point from the idea of a communicatio between friends. Right? He does this little division. He winnows out. If you love someone not for their sake but for your sake, no, that's not what we're talking about. That's the way you love a glass of wine, right? That's not the way you love a friend. If you love someone for their own sake but there's no mutuality to it, that's also not friendship. That's that might be, maybe that there may be some wonderful novelist out there who's read Dr. Arbery's fiction and thinks he's a great fiction writer. Maybe by coincidence, Dr. Arbery has read his fiction and they're mutually thinking each other are wonderful, but they've never met, have no idea that they're reading each other, and it's not a friendship, right? It's just admiration or love. So what is it that actually establishes a friendship? St. Thomas says that it's in the reading packet it's translated as a sharing. It's a communicatio. And he's getting the word from Aristotle. Communicatio is the translation for the term that Dr. Virginia gave us the other day, koinonia. Right? This is where Aristotle says, in a line from the Ethics, all friendship is in koinonia. That's the idea that St. Thomas is appealing to here. So if you recall, the idea that Aristotle presents is that so koinonia is rooted in koinos, which means something common. So when there's a group of people that have something in common, that leads to a kind of bond between them. So Aristotle gives the example of sailors on a ship. We're all in this boat together, right, as the saying goes, right? And that leads to what Aristotle would call some form of friendship. May not be the best kind or the most full, the fullest meaning of the word, but it's a form of friendship already. Just by being in the same family, you already have a bunch in common. You have common ancestry, common memories, right? And these things are the foundation of friendship. Right? They root that mutuality that friendship needs. Same thing with members of a city, right? We are reading from the Politics. Started paragraph 1 of book 1 of Aristotle's Politics says every koinonia has to do with some kind of common good, right? He immediately jumps into the idea of this sharing, this fellowship, this common stake in some kind of good that's going to link us all together. And just by being citizens of the same city, there's a kind of political friendship immediately. Which could be improved on in various ways, right? But right away, that koinonia establishes this, roots the relationship. So if we want to talk about friendship with God, St. Thomas is going to guide us into this idea and ask, what kind of koinonia, what kind of fellowship can a man have with God? What can a man have in common with God? Right? you could run with this a long time, right? You could say, you could describe all of salvation history using this as kind of your thematic point, right? Start with our first parents in the Garden of Eden in this close relationship with God where they're described as walking with God in the cool of the evening. That's obviously trying to communicate a kind of fellowship, a day-to-day commerce between man and God. Of course, they blow it, and their blowing it is described, among other ways, as being cast far from the face of God. There's a distance introduced between man and God, and Abraham believes in God, and James says in his letter that therefore he was called a friend of God, right? The friendship with God is Abraham's toehold at the beginning of salvation history. The tabernacle brings God back into the midst of people. You could argue that the book of Numbers is largely about how hard that was, right? All the difficulties we've talked about with friendship of God, you could say that's the theme of the book of Numbers. You get God right in the middle of the people, and look what happens. People are getting swallowed up by the earth. People are getting roasted alive. You know, it's a disaster, right? This is so the Old Testament kind of, while introducing the possibility of some kind of koinonia between God and man, also emphasizes the real problem, even the danger of such a venture. You could continue that narrative with St. Thomas on the Incarnation, when he talks about why did God become incarnate. At least the way I read him, he ultimately comes down to saying it was to communicate, he uses that verb, to establish a communicatio, to communicate himself to his creature. Right? So the Incarnation itself is the ultimate dwelling of God with man, establishing some kind of fellowship by actually becoming a man. But where St. Thomas takes us here in this reading, I'm going to drop that imagined book we could write, and just focus. What he says here is that which even the Incarnation was coming to bring. He says that there is a sharing between man and God. There is a communicatio between man and God, a koinonia between man and God, inasmuch as he shares his happiness with us. That's another one of those phrases you can get way too notional about. We need to dig into it, make it kind of real. Let's unpack that for a minute. God shares his happiness with us. So when we're talking about the ethics, and some also when we talked about the politics, we were bringing out that fulfillment is inevitably related to nature. What it means to be fulfilled, well, tell me what you are, right? Are you a dog? Are you a man? Those are going to be different games. Happiness, right? Can rocks be happy? I feel like they can't. They can kind of come to rest.
You have to ask Dr.
Bill. Yeah. He's the closest to the rocks of all of us. Not in his... That came out wrong. But... but he's, yeah, you sort of feel like, I've never even heard someone describe a rock as happy. Because of the lack of any awareness whatsoever. And St. Thomas talks about the very stones loving God above all things with a kind of natural affection. We could try to talk about what the heck does that mean. But it's a weird way to talk, is what I'm saying, right? It's hard. When you're down the realm of the minerals, happiness is a hard word, right? Maybe we can get it done. You get up to plants, that's a little easier. I mean, as I was leaving today, I was saying that my son, 4-year-old, wanted to go out and water the plants in the garden. I said, oh, the plants are going to be happy that you watered them. I'm aware as I say that I'm using a metaphor, but it feels like a natural one because plants react somehow to their environment. You know, they're a little closer. It doesn't feel as weird. When you get to dogs and horses, I'm totally comfortable talking about a happy dog, right? But there again, we realize that we don't mean the same thing when we say happy as we do when we refer to a human being, right? The dog's nature is less, and correspondingly, the happiness open to him is less. The happiest, most fulfilled, blessed dog of them all could not be as happy as the happiness that human nature allows, right? And if we continue on up the chain, the happiness that would be natural to a man is going to be lesser than the natural happiness of an angel because the nature is higher. And the happiness natural to an angel is going to be less than the happiness of a seraphim, naturally speaking, right? And so if you just continue on up, you realize since God's nature is, and again, we have to try to avoid that merely notional use of these words, but since God's nature is infinitely beyond every conceivable creature, the happiness natural to God is also impossibly far away from the happiness natural to any conceivable creature, right? And so that means that God sharing his happiness with us would be just unthinkable, just impossible. Not, I mean, just like talk about a square circle, except for the kind of astonishing claims we have in the New Testament, right? So the second letter of Peter says, we have become koinones, partakers of fellows in the divine nature, right? The Gospel of John says we've been given the power to become children of God, right? The first letter of John says, that which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you may have koinonia with us. And our koinonia is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. And later in the same text, he says, see what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, for so we are, right? So the key step is that in a way that will remain a mystery, this is a mystery of our faith, God has given us a share in his nature. That God has made us children of God, and that has opened the possibility of sharing the happiness unique to the divinity with us. And that's going to be the koinonia, St. Thomas says, the fellowship, the partnership that's going to ground actual friendship with God. So if a share in God's own nature sort of qualifies us for a share in God's unique happiness, okay, so what's the happiness, right? What's the deal, right? What are the goods you get in that box? What is the blessedness unique to God? Well, the passage from the first letter of John that I read above continues this way. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. The book of Revelation describes the final happiness of believers this way. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. St. Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthians, gives us this description of our final fulfillment. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully, even as I have been fully understood. So you can see why St. Thomas will reasonably conclude the happiness unique to God alone, the happiness that he has communicated to us, is the face-to-face vision of him. Now, again, this constant danger of merely notional thinking, right? Just letting the word, oh, face-to-face vision, that sounds great. I'll take two. St. Thomas offers a helpful analysis of what face-to-face must mean in this context that might clear away a little bit of the vagueness of our thinking. Obviously, we're not talking about seeing with the eyeballs, right? God is not a body. He doesn't have color. He doesn't have shape, right? So what does it mean that we're seeing him, and what does it mean that we're seeing him face-to-face? Well, we're talking about, I guess you could say, seeing with the mind, but it's not like ordinary seeing with the mind either, because in our ordinary intellectual knowledge, we know things by having ideas about them, right? So I know cows by having the idea cow. I can contemplate cows. I know trees by having the idea tree in my mind, right? But heaven, eternal happiness, does not consist of having a really grand idea about God. Right? That's not what we've been promised. The problem that St. Thomas brings out is this. As we keep saying, God's being is infinite, right? We have to really hold on to that and make that vivid to ourselves. God's being is infinite. Any idea that he could create in our minds would be a creature and therefore finite. And so it would be infinitely short of representing him. Trying to know God through an idea about God would be like contemplating human beings through the idea rock, except that rocks are not infinitely distant from us in the scale of being. Right? So the solution, St. Thomas argues, has to be this. This knowledge that the New Testament is talking about is one in which God himself takes the place of the idea. Right? Where you can't do that with a tree, because a tree is bulky, right? If you had a tree in your head, right? But God is, being wholly immaterial, is somehow, and this is one of the deepest mysteries to me, but God, St. Thomas argues, must take the place of the idea. The divine being itself has to become the shape of the inmost consciousness of the saint in heaven, the form of the mind. Not an idea about God, but the divine being itself, right, has to do that. Again, this gets pretty heady, right? Like, oh my goodness, I don't even know what we're talking about now. So I always want to slow down and try to make it real, to get away from the notional here. So right now we're seeing each other face to face, and this is grand. I'm enjoying it. But I think we can all admit that the fleshy stuff that hangs off my skull is very often a mask that I put on in the morning before I leave the house, right? So maybe my grandmother died and I'm grieving, but I'm going to put on my work face before I go to the office. Or maybe your sister is experiencing depression and you're very, very anxious about her, but you're going to put a good face on it when you go to pick the kids up, right? There are very few people that we allow to see ourselves, to see us as we are, right? And that has its limitations, right? Even those closest to us sometimes misunderstand us really badly. And they never understand us perfectly, right? So this coming Saturday, I'm going to celebrate 20 years of marriage with my wife. And we have had a very close friendship. And the weird thing is we're still getting to know each other, right? And isn't it true that the typical failure in a marriage, the day-to-day failures, is the imputation of a tone or a motivation or a kind of edge on a comment that wasn't there, right? We just don't have a soloscope by which to peer into each other's real condition and inclinations. And the consequence is sometimes it can feel like there are moments in life when you feel like you're trapped behind the fleshy mask, right? Desperately sending up smoke signals hoping somebody will see, right? All right. At life's hardest moments, it gets pretty lonely in there. There's only one, Scripture says, there's only one who sees us directly and exactly as we are. And St. Paul tells us that heaven will be understanding that one as he has already understood you. Right? So the novelty of heaven will not just be seeing God's face. There's a really real sense in which it'll be the first time any of us have seen a face. Right? The long loneliness is over. Right? There is a friendship here at last that all other friendships have yearned for. Right? This dropping of the barriers is what even a great marriage angles toward and never quite succeeds in achieving. And remember, the face we're seeing is the being that is the ground of our very being, right? Our root and source. And that being, which is the very ground of our being, has now become the form of our consciousness. So to see God is not only an epiphany, it's a homecoming. That's the communicatio St. Thomas is talking about. That's what he says is the anchor of friendship with God. That grounds Christian charity. That's what makes it different, in St. Thomas's argument, from every other admirable love, every other friendship. St. Thomas has a wonderful passage in his commentary on the Ten Commandments I'd like to read to you, where he sort of crystallizes this. All creatures serve the divine majesty, since they were all made by him, as manufactured goods serve their maker. But charity turns a slave into a free man and a friend. So the Lord said to the apostles, I no longer call you slaves, but friends. And again, charity makes us not only free people, but also sons, so that we can be called and be sons of God. For an outsider becomes the adopted son of someone when he acquires a right to his property. So also charity acquires for us a right to the inheritance of God, which is eternal life. Because if we are sons, we are also heirs, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. So there's the, I think, the kind of leading point St. Thomas would offer us, right? When Christ says that the first and greatest commandment is you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength, the depth that St. Thomas wants to see in that is this idea of friendship rooted in the communication of God's happiness. That's what we have to get. But there's a little bit of a danger here. By the time I've finished walking with St. Thomas through this picture, it can be a very me and God kind of picture we have in our minds. My divine lover and I enjoying some private time, you know, some one-on-one in heaven. But St. Thomas's idea of charity is very political. Right? So you remember that passage I read in the book of Revelation a while ago about they shall see him face to face, that his name shall be on their forehead? That line is part of a description of the city of God coming down out of the heavens like a bride adorned for the bridegroom, right? It's a description of a city. It's describing the good that unites a city. I want to sort of jump towards the end of the reading. Here in this disputed question on charity, St. Thomas makes his political read of charity very explicit. He says that, as the philosopher says in Book 8 of the Politics, for one to be considered politically good, I'm a little way down in that first paragraph, for one to be considered politically good, he must love the good of the state. Now, when a man is admitted to participating in the good of some state and made a citizen of that state, he needs certain virtues for doing those things which are a citizen's duty, and for he needs love of the good of the state. In the same way, when a man through grace is admitted to participation in heavenly beatitude, that's the labor that we just went through, right? We talked about what that means. When that happens, which the heavenly beatitude, which consists in the vision and enjoyment of God, he becomes, as it were, a citizen and a sharer in that blessed society which is called the heavenly Jerusalem. Right? So, why would that be? Right? Why does St. Thomas think that this friendship with God is necessarily political, necessarily at the root of a society? I think what he has in mind is something that St. Augustine says at the beginning of his treatise on Christian doctrine. St. Augustine says, a possession which is not diminished by being shared with others, if it is possessed and not shared, is not yet possessed as it ought to be possessed. Right? Let me read that again. A possession which is not diminished by being shared with others, if it is possessed and not shared, is not yet possessed as it ought to be possessed. I think this is something that's so intuitive for St. Thomas, he'll just allude to it in a phrase without unpacking it. I want to rotate around this idea for a minute. So we've talked about this in our conversations. We've talked about the one who, you know, Aristotle describes the one who we call selfish is the one who prefers lower goods for himself. In fact, the virtuous one that we don't criticize, he also prefers goods for himself, but he prefers higher goods. And then there's no conflict because the goods he prefers can be shared with others, right? Maybe he prefers the flourishing of the city. Well, hey, that's not something that's just his. So he doesn't appear selfish to us, even though he's still wanting the good for himself. So there are lesser goods. There are greater goods. And here, one way to describe it would be this. Those lesser goods, those lower goods, they're just less powerfully good. They're like one of those little hand warmers, you know, you can buy at the grocery store. You know, you shake them up and put them in your glove and they keep your hand warm. That's good and all, but it's just your hand. It's not very hot. If you had a bonfire now, that would be a different thing, but you just got a little thing in your glove. And very low goods are like that, like cake. I like cake. It's pretty good. But it's got this limitation, right? My piece of cake can only be my piece of cake. If I give you some, I have less. Each bite you eat is a bite I didn't eat. Right? And that's because cake's not just cake. Greater goods are more powerfully good. They're capable of being good for more people. So for example, truth. If you learn a truth that I learned, I don't come in and say, hey, who took my truth? I had it right here. Right? It's no problem. Truth can be shared without being, in fact, the experience of teachers, right, is that by sharing truth, you actually acquire it more for yourself. Right? Friendship. You can't even have friendship without sharing friendship. What would it even mean to say, hey, buddy, this is my friendship here. This is your friend, right? And lo and behold, truth and friendship are both way, way, way better than cake. Right? So greater goods are by their nature capable of being sharing. And then they fall under St. Augustine's dictum, right? Because if you think about the guy, who wants to possess truth but not share it. Right, this would be like this, the story we mentioned the other day in one of our subgroups about when Aristotle published his treatise on metaphysics, his old student, Alexander the Great, wrote to him in displeasure. Right? You spilled the beans. You know, what is it, Alexander complained, what is it that's going to set us apart from the multitudes now? Because this was the wisdom that we had and they didn't. Right? Now, Aristotle's response is in some ways disappointing. He responds, I have written and I have not written. If you pick up the metaphysics, you'll probably see what he means. It's not like those people are going to understand this anyway. But, you know, what you sort of wish Aristotle would have said is, hey, listen, buddy, if you love truth for what it is, then you're loving it as something shareable. If you love truth for what it is not, right? If you love truth as a weapon that gives you a leg up in the scramble for the top, you're not loving it as truth. Right? And we've all known these people, right? The people who they enjoy what they know because it makes them better. And I think you could say St. Augustine would say they're not loving that good as it should be loved. Right? So since God is absolute goodness, right? A goodness of infinite power. He can be the supreme good of every creature in the universe without being divvied up at all, without being diminished in the slightest. Right? He is supremely capable of being shared. So God is, by his nature, a common good, and the most common good of all goods. And that means that if we're going to love him the way he should be loved, we're going to love him as shareable, right? Now, that would be true already just of natural love of God. Right? If we, let's carry it over to the idea of this beatific vision that we've sketched. You know, we talked about truth being shareable. So I am over here thinking a truth. Jim's over there thinking the same truth. We both have the truth. But if you look closely, of course, while we're both thinking about the same thing, each of us has our individual thoughts about it, right? Each of us has our individual instantiation of the idea, one in Jim and one in me. But if you think about what's going on in heaven, we don't just all the same idea about God. We don't just all agree about God, right? It's not just like we're all on the same page, right? The exact same divine being is the shape of all of our inmost consciousnesses, right? The exact same divine being is the form of every mind, the same individual being, right? The only experience we have like this on earth is when all of us in church receive the numerically one body of Christ, right? And then each of us go back to our pews with this numerically the same thing inside us. That's sort of an echo of what happens in heaven. It's more truly sharing even than truth can be shared in this life. So with something so ultimately shareable, you have to love it as shareable, which means you have to love it as the root of a community, as what makes the city of God cohere. That's charity. So when we say that Christian love is the love we have for God, we're adding a nuance here. If we look at on page 129, St. Thomas has this wonderful warning in the second paragraph of that disputed question. He says, granted, charity is the love of the good of the city of God, right? But one can love the good of any society in two ways. In one way, so as to possess it. In another way, so as to preserve it. But to love the good of any society so that it might be had or possessed does not constitute the political good. For this is how even a tyrant loves the good of a city in order to dominate it, which is to love himself more than the city. For he desires this good for himself, not for the city. Right? He's loving the good of the city not as the good of the city, but for something that it's not. He's loving it as though it's a merely private good. But to love the good of the city so that it might be preserved and defended, this is indeed to love the city. And this constitutes the political good, so much so that men would expose themselves to dangers of death or neglect their own private good in order to preserve or increase the good of the city. Right? Because the individual citizen sees that the common good is his own good, and it's more his own good than his merely private good. Right? When we talk about the common good, we're not talking about something that's set over against the individual's good. We're talking about the ranking of goods. His private good is his least goods. The common good is his greatest good. And he'll sacrifice the least for the greatest in a heartbeat. That's loving the city, right? Whereas the tyrant is sacrificing the greatest to the least, right? And St. Thomas concludes with, this is kind of chilling, right? Therefore, to love the good in which the blessed participate, right? To love the beatific vision, to want to enjoy God in that vision, so that it might be had or possessed, does not make a man well disposed toward beatitude. Because, get this, the wicked also desire this good. Right, so as we refine our idea of what charity means, this idea that charity is fundamentally, if we can stick with the way that Dr. Virginia always uses it and abandon the way that it's always used on the internet these days, fundamentally political, right? That charity is fundamentally a community thing. It's not just me and God. Now we see, okay, so we have to add this further nuance. Charity is not just loving God above all things. It's loving him rooted in the communication of his own happiness. But it's not even just that. It's not wanting to possess that. It's loving that good for what it is, right? As a shareable good, not just as a private good, which is something that the wicked would also want. But to love that good for its own sake, in order that it might remain and be widespread, and that nothing might be done against that good, this does dispose man well toward that society of the blessed. This is charity, which loves God for his own sake, and loves fellow men who are capable of attaining beatitude as it loves itself. This is charity, which loves God for his own sake, in the manner that we describe, right? And loves fellow men who are capable of attaining beatitude as it loves itself. So there we see the pivot from the first half of Christ's twofold commandment towards the second half, right? We've been talking about what it means to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength, and finding the various nuances you have to keep adding to it to retain the force of that statement. But once we've added that final nuance that you have to love God precisely as shareable, as the root of at the bond of a community, now you've pivoted toward the second half of Jesus' commandment, and your neighbor as yourself. So how are we going to love our neighbor as ourselves? How does loving God precisely as shareable play out in terms of love of others? There's a wonderful passage in St. Augustine's treatise on Christian doctrine that I think kind of describes what St. Thomas is thinking, and it's long, but I'd like to read it to you. I just think it's a wonderful illustration. This is St. Augustine from On Christian Doctrine, talking about what does it mean to love your neighbor? How do we love them? We ought to desire that they should all join with us in loving God, and all the assistance that we either give them or accept from them should tend to that one end. For in the theaters, dens of iniquity though they be. If a man is fond of a particular actor and enjoys his art as a great or even as the very greatest good, he is fond of all who join with him in admiration of his favorite, not for their own sakes, but for the sake of him whom they admire in common. You love Brad Pitt too? Ah, but, you know. And the more fervent he is in his admiration, the more he works in every way he can to secure new admirers for him, and the more anxious he becomes to show him to others. And if he finds anyone comparatively indifferent, he does all he can to excite his interest by urging his favorite's merits. If, however, he meet with anyone who oppose him, he is exceedingly displeased by such a man's contempt of his favorite, and he strives in every way he can to remove it. Now, if this be so, what does it become us to do, who live in the fellowship of the love of God, the enjoyment of whom is true happiness of life, to whom all who love him owe both their existence and the love they bear him, concerning whom we have no fear that anyone who comes to know him will be disappointed in him, and who desires our love not for any gain to himself, but that those who love him may obtain an eternal reward, even himself whom they love. And hence it is that we love even our enemies. For we do not fear them, seeing that they cannot take away from us what we love, but we pity them rather, because the more they hate us, the more they are separated from him whom we love. I think that's a great description of how St. Thomas would play out this idea that if you love God as the shareable good, as the greatest common good, the most common of goods, what does that mean in terms of how you act towards other people? Well, it means you have an immediate bond with anyone who's with you there, right? Anyone who's not with you, you try to make them with you, right? You bug them. People who just will not be bugged, you pity them. Like, oh, I'm so sorry. You cannot join me in this love that I have. So if we look at let's go back to St. Thomas on this point. St. Thomas has a fairly technical way of getting into the same point, talking about the species of acts. He's in other words, St. Thomas is asking this question. Granted that, you know, Christians all think that charity is both love of God and love of neighbor. Are those two different charities? Are like different kinds of love? So you love God with one kind of love and you love your neighbor with a different kind of love? And St. Thomas argues, no, they're not different kinds of love. They're in fact the same love, the same charity. And he gives this example. It is specifically the same in species, the same visual act whereby we see the light and whereby we see the color under the aspect of light. I mean, think about that. Is it one kind of act by which I see light and another kind of act by which I see the brown of the table? St. Thomas would say, no. In fact, it's by seeing light that you're seeing the brown of the table. That's how you do it. So it's, even though we can talk about two things I'm seeing, the one is the way that I see the other. And he says, that's what happens with love of neighbor. In the next paragraph, now the aspect under which our neighbor is to be loved is God, since what we ought to love at our neighbor is that he may be in God. Right? The bond by which we love our neighbor with Christian charity is that friendship we had with God. It's just that now that friendship becomes the aspect under which we have friendship with others. We have that in common with them now. The fellowship we have with God instantly establishes fellowship with others. But it's that first fellowship that's creating the second. So it's the same charity. It's the same love that loves the first and loves the second. So all the work we do to establish the first half of Christ's commandment just rides on into the second half and your neighbor. Right? Because the first half is driving the second half. Just recently, I was reading a letter to the Colossians, just sort of devotionally, and in light of this topic, this line from chapter 1 jumped out at me. St. Paul says to the Colossians, we have heard of your faith in Christ Jesus and of the love which you have for all the saints because of the hope laid up for you in heaven. And it suddenly struck me, St. Paul saying, that the hope you have laid up for you in heaven is the driver behind your love for all the saints. Right? That's the bond. That's the aspect under which you see them and say, hey, brother, hey, friend.
Indeed, wrote St. Thomas Aquinas, so much do we love our friends that for their sake we love all who belong to them, even if they hurt or hate us. So that in this way, the friendship of charity extends even to our enemies, whom we love out of charity in relation to God, to whom the friendship of charity is chiefly directed. Summertime brings us and our neighbors outdoors. As a result, much more so than in the winter, we have the opportunity to renew or begin friendships with those around us. St. Thomas, while no doubt he would have used more polished language, would, I think, have encouraged us to go for it. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tomkiewicz.